Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Historic turmoil in the markets this week and in the streets of London as Republicans vie in Iowa. A wild roller coaster in the stock market. Whiplash and confusion for investors.
The lows of the afternoon on Monday down 635 points.
We saw stocks rise 429 points on the Dow.
The Dow plummeting more than 500 points, ending the day at the lows of the day. The Dow closing up with a better than 400-point move.
Oh boy, last night in Ames, Iowa, 8 GOP contenders took the stage before Iowa's straw poll. Former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty took aim at Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann.
She said she's got a titanium spine. It's not her spine we're worried about. It's her record of results. If that's your view of effective leadership with results, please stop because you're killing us.
And in London and around the UK, days and nights of fierce riots and looting. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Rana Faruhar of Time Magazine, Steve Chapman of the Chicago Tribune, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the wild ride on Wall Street, the chaos in London, the GOP contenders on the stump in Iowa? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Rana Faruhar joins us from New York, assistant managing editor at Time Magazine with a hot column there on economics, author of Time's cover story next week, The Decline and Fall of Europe and Maybe the West. Rana, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
From Chicago, recently in from Iowa, we're joined by Steve Chapman, columnist and editorial writer for the Chicago Tribune. Steve, great to have you back.
Nice to be here.
And hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Ryan, and Steve.
Let's go right away to Wall Street. It ties into everything else. Here was middle of the week, Art Cashin, one of the most prominent traders on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, talking to ABC World News as the stock market was, on that day, melting down in the final hour of trading.
It's not a full-blown panic yet, but it could get there. They're not throwing things out the window quite yet, but they're not far from it if this keeps up.
Not far from it, and then things came back, down and up and down and up. Here was J.P. Morgan Chase Chairman and CEO Jamie Dimon, interviewed by CNBC in Monterey, California this week. Of course, he's got an interest here, but he said the sinking markets were nothing to worry about.
You know, if I thought it was a calamity, I'd go back to New York, but I think this is just a lot of volatility in the marketplace, and America will get through this too.
Are you telling your team to do anything differently this week?
Well, look, obviously, where we take risk, you know, on our trading floors, people are careful. But, you know, they're still doing business with clients. A lot of the markets are fine. Repo markets, mortgage markets, some of the credit markets still open.
Just a lot of volatility in the marketplace. Well, I guess so. Rana Faruhar, what do you make of what we saw this week? I mean, these were historic sort of zigs and zags in stock markets.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's not just a lot of volatility.
No.
Historically, this is the most volatile four-day period we've seen since the S&P started tracking these things back in 1928. So it's really unbelievable. And I think what's happening is that you've got a lot of mixed messages coming in the marketplace. You've got the Eurozone crisis, which is really threatening to destabilize the single currency. But the reason that that crisis is coming to a head now is because of the really bad economic news in the U.S. And I don't mean the debt news. A lot of times people think that this is all correlated to the debt. And the downgrade was just rubber stamping what we already knew, which is that our growth prospects are really, really slow. We are in the 2% or less than 2% economy, and that's what's at the heart of this.
That's super low growth and Europe teetering over everything. I mean, your headline next week is talking about the end, the decline, the end of the West.
Well, I think what we're realizing, ever since the financial crisis and this last 3 years of economic malaise, we've been kidding ourselves. We've been looking for excuses. We've blamed everything from the tsunami to lack of market certainty. You know, people on the street love to talk about that. The fact is we've had certainty. What we don't have is growth. We had less than 1% growth in this last quarter, followed by 0.4% in the previous quarter. The Fed was betting on 4% growth earlier this year. It looks like we're going to have half that. So what's happening is we are in something that's much bigger even And more important than a double-dip recession, we're in what Ken Rogoff up at Harvard, who's one of the really preeminent seers of this crisis, I would say, is calling the Great Contraction, a period of several years of slow growth off the back of the debt unwinding that came from the financial crisis. And I think we're just beginning to come to terms with all of the ramifications of that.
And it's going to hurt. It's hurting already. Here on Monday, the European Central Bank bought Italian and Spanish bonds, those big economies in trouble there, at risk of default with who knows what consequences. In exchange, those countries will implement further austerity measures. Here's Italian financial analyst Danilo Caselli talking with NPR earlier this week.
It's clear that our government has been put into receivership by the European Central Bank. Our course has been charted. All Italians will have to undergo very painful austerity measures for the next 3 years. The question now is to see exactly what they will be.
Next 3 years, Steve Chapman, the Fed essentially saying this week that they don't foresee any comeback during until 2013. That's the rest of Barack Obama's political term. What do you see coming for the U.S. economy here, Steve? And what are investors to think when, you know, the sort of lit fuse is all over the place?
You know, I think that's what accounts for the volatility in the stock market this week. I mean, remember, we're 4 years removed from the beginning of the recession. We're 2 years into the recovery officially.
Quote, unquote, recovery.
Right. And at this point in a, you know, in a recovery, things are normally, you know, humming along pretty well. All the indicators are looking better. And in this one, instead of things getting steadily better, things are really not getting better at all. And in some respects, they're getting worse. And on top of that, you have all the doubts about European sovereign debt, and which is, you know, which has an effect not only in Europe, but it has an effect because a lot of U.S. banks hold some of that debt, and you know, there's no prospect that the U.S. Congress and the President are going to come to any sort of a reasonable agreement that's going to bring our fiscal troubles under control. So. There's a, you know, a lot of reasons for investors to be nervous, and there's a lot of reasons for the Fed to say, you know, things are not really going to pick up anytime soon.
Jack, let's just remember the sequence of events here. I mean, there was the whole summer-long debate over the debt ceiling in this country. People called it an artificial crisis created by Republicans determined to go after that deficit and frame our problems in terms of the deficit. Of course, Paul Krugman and others saying that's just exactly backwards. Then we have the downgrade, which is it seems like ancient history, but it's only a few wild swings of the market ago, and then all that volatility. And here we stand, Jack, looking out where nobody exactly knows what's coming next.
Including the public. A Washington Post poll this week finds that it asks, do you think the federal government is mostly focused on the wrong thing? 71% say yes, mostly focused on the wrong things. The entire political class has been sort of almost pixelated by this deficit reduction, debt reduction, at a time when, to hear Paul Krugman, the markets are saying, we're not worried about the deficit. We want growth. We want the economy to pick up. And there seems to be no one in Washington who is talking that talk. And in terms of policy, that seems so far beyond what we're going to anything feasible. The president, you know, offered some feeble suggestions, create, you know, extend unemployment and so on. Well, that's grand, and I'm sure it could work with a different Congress. But to me, the whole week was typified by the president's remarks, where he said, you know, America remains a AAA country. Well, to any Major League Baseball fan, that's no comfort.
Yeah, and who knows if it's even true. I mean, Steve Chapman, when the president says we've always been and will always be a AAA nation, is that just rhetoric at this point? Do you still feel that in your bones? Will always be?
I think that is rhetoric. There's no guarantee that it will always be, and if we don't find some ways to turn the economy around, to get, you know, our debt under control, no, there's no guarantee at all that we'll be a AAA country 10, 20, 30 years from now.
Rana, every time the market goes swooping back up, people want to relax and say, okay, here we go. And there are better retail numbers out today. People happy about those. But many others saying we're not through this at all yet. Ken Rogoff, you mentioned, a big economist, he spoke with us this week. He said, look, we may have to have very large-scale restructuring of debt right down to individual homes' mortgages, and we may need a good dose of inflation, 4, 5, 6%, to get out of this situation. That's more radical talk.
It is more radical talk. I mean, what Rogoff is arguing for, of course, is moderate inflation, 4 to 6%. But inflation is a tricky thing to orchestrate, and that's why central bankers are very concerned about it. Very, very hard to move the levers correctly on that. I think what's really interesting about this crisis on both sides of the Atlantic, though, is that it is political. You know, in the U.S., there are solutions. There are things that we can do to get this situation under control, mainly to do with a sort of a coming together, some sensible tax reform, but also some sensible entitlement cuts. Of course, the debt deal that we have on the table has got us neither of those things. In Europe, but at least here, we have the political institutions that if our both sides of the table could come together, we could fix the problem. Mm-hmm. In Europe, what's interesting is that they don't even have the institutions politically to fix the problem, and that's why things are so out of control there. You have the central bank, which has been operating like something of a casino in recent years. You know, member countries can come in and borrow as much as they want.
A little more.
Little more, you know, rather than making the sort of painful cuts that you're seeing in the UK, which are leading to riots. That's another story. But, you know, instead of doing that, they're borrowing more. But then there's no political oversight. There's no one that can step up and say, hey, Italy, Spain, Portugal, you know what? You've got to clean up your act. You can't keep borrowing more than you can handle because that's going to endanger the single currency for everyone.
They could still hit a wall there. You say China may have to offer some relief at some point. Who knows if that'll happen? Rana Faruhar, please stand by in New York. Steve Chapman in Chicago. Jack Beatty, great to have you here. We're looking at a big week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a big week in the news. Market mayhem, London riots, Republicans girding for battle. Rana Faruhar is with us from Time Magazine, assistant managing editor there with a hot column and the cover story next week, The Decline and Fall of Europe and Maybe the West. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. Steve Chapman is with us from Chicago, columnist and editorial writer for the Chicago Tribune. Our own Jack Beatty is here. Let's go to our listeners, Lisa in Boston. Thanks for calling, Lisa. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a question about the Dow Jones history. I know nothing about the economy, but because the Dow Jones has been in the news so much, I was looking up records online and charts.
Okay.
Chart, like the last week or the last. And I found a chart that goes all the way back to 28. And what happens is there's like a steady rate of change from like 28 through to about the 80s. And then the rate of change shifts and it becomes much faster, and then when it hits 94 it almost goes vertical. I want to know what happened in 94 that, because it seems to me when you look at it just as a graphic that the rate of change that occurred from 94 on it made it completely unsustainable. There's no way that we could maintain that rate of change.
Lisa, that graphic is really worth looking at, and let us pick it up, and I appreciate your call, Rana. I mean,
fascinating. that's I'm really glad that you brought that up. That goes exactly to the financialization of America. You mentioned that I don't have the trend in front, or excuse me, the chart in front of me, of course, but I think you mentioned that you started to see the shift in the 80s, heats up in the 90s. Well, the 80s is when you saw massive deregulation. It's when you saw a lot of movement into equities. Wall Street as a percentage of the economy began to increase. So you had this sort of financialization of America, which started in the 80s and has reached its apex, really, now. In fact, last year, I believe in 2010, was the highest percentage of finance as a percentage of the overall economy since the Gilded Era. So what you're seeing is Wall Street taking up a lot more of the space in our economy, and I think that has led to volatility. What's interesting is at the same time over that period, the number of new businesses being started has declined. Now, that goes to this very interesting argument. If you remember, In 2008, when the banks wanted to be bailed out, they told us, if you don't bail us out, nobody else can be healthy. We're the ones that grease the economy. Well, it's interesting that as Wall Street's gotten bigger, the number of small businesses has been declining. So something that's another topic, perhaps.
Another topic, but also that Americans of a whole generation and more now have been used to that very vigorous climb, many now saying that may be behind us with consequences of its own. Delcy in Milford, Connecticut, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Delcy.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
This is very confusing because Congress continually writes legislation allowing our big businesses to operate offshore with a very high profitability and low taxes. And yet we lent banks money with no caveat to help start small businesses. So where are the jobs going to come from? And it seems that big business no longer needs the American worker. They just need Congress to write the necessary legislation for them to continue to make huge sums of money.
Delcy, let us pick it up. Steve Chapman, you're sitting there in Chicago, right in the middle of the country. Delcy wants to know where the jobs are going to come from, and you know, why is it that we bail out banks, but then they're not lending it on down?
Well, I don't think you're going to get an increase in jobs until you get an increase in demand in the economy. It's if you're a corporation, you may want to open a plant in China because that's where the customers are. That's where the demand is growing.
But how do you get demand when you don't have jobs? You don't have wage growth. You're cutting government jobs. At least those were people who would buy things. You're cutting government programs that at least put some cash out there.
Well, until the economy starts to pick up, I don't think you're going to get corporations creating jobs, and I don't think it really matters who the banks are willing to lend to until that happens. You're going to be stuck in this rut, and I think once the economy begins to recover, you'll get job growth across all sectors, with a few exceptions like the construction industry, which is not going to come back anytime soon because we're way overbuilt in housing in most places.
But Jack, I mean, the demand comes from the little guy, and the little guy is the one who's been taking it. I mean, they say, somebody was writing recently, sales are pretty good at Nordstrom's, high end, and bottom Walmart. But what about that middle?
That middle, yeah. There's a fine cover story in the Atlantic Monthly this month about the decline of the crisis of the middle class. And that begins with a very similar piece of information that a leading analyst for banks was talking about the economy to come and saying, look, basically, this is an economy for the rich. That's all we have to make your products for them, do everything for them. The 85% on the bottom half, they don't count in this economy. And they used a word for it, plutonomy, an economy in which the rich generate the growth, in which they are the source of the economy, and in which most of the other people just sort of.
But here's Steve Chapman, Rana. He's no liberal, and he's saying you got to have demand to get things going here. Where's it going to come from?
Well, it's interesting. 95% of the people in this country who are not millionaires do 71% of the spending. So it is a problem. This idea that you can have a high-low economy with a shrinking middle really doesn't hold. What's interesting is that that doesn't mean that companies are going to want to start putting jobs here. As we heard before, there's really no reason for them to put their next factory in Iowa. They want to put it in China, Brazil, India, where the middle class, by the way, is booming, and there's a lot of new customers coming online. That's creating a divergence between the fortunes of companies and the fortunes of workers, and you can see that in the markets because a lot of the Fortune 5 are doing just fine. They've got most of their business overseas, but they're not creating jobs here at home.
Lots of talk about the economy in the Republican debate last night in Iowa. Lots of listeners watching that and paying attention. Let's go to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Wilder. Wilder, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
There's three things I'd like to say. You mentioned what do we think about the Republican field? I really like Michelle Bachmann from the standpoint that I really believe what she says. When she says something, I think she's going to stick to her guns and really, really do what she says. I think Mitt Romney is going to say whatever he needs to say to get elected. The second thing I want to mention is, I scratch my head about the interest that we pay on the debt. It's clear, I mean, it should be clear to Democrats and Republicans that, you know, this year we're paying $600 billion in interest.
Yep.
If we keep borrowing the way we're borrowing, 2 years from now we'll be paying $800 billion. 4 years from now we'll be paying $1 trillion.
Hey, Waldo, I know exactly what you mean, and it's terrifying. On the other hand, if our economy stinks, if we don't get it revved up again and our ratings get downgraded, we'll be paying more that way, too. Our interest rates go way up.
I couldn't agree more. So it should be clear to everybody that the interest we're paying on the debt is going up, and pretty soon it's going to overtake our budget entirely.
I guess the debate is over what you do about that, but let us pick it up, Wilder, on you're in the Michelle Bachmann corner, and that Bachmann-Tim Pawlenty dynamic was right at the heart of the debate on stage last night in Iowa. Wilder, let us listen to a little bit of that. You're there in Pittsburgh. Here was the sound from Ames, Iowa, as Tim Pawlenty first went after his fellow Minnesotan, Michelle Bachmann.
She says that she's fighting for these things. She fought for less government spending. We got a lot more. She led the effort against Obamacare. We got Obamacare. She led the effort against TARP. We got TARP. She said she's got a titanium spine. It's not her spine we're worried about. It's her record of results. If that's your view of effective leadership with results, please stop, because you're killing us.
Wait. Congressman Bachmann, 30 seconds to respond.
Thank you so much. I was at the tip of the spear fighting against the implementation of Obamacare in the United States Congress. Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, and Barack Obama ran Congress, but I gave them a run for their money.
Michelle Bachmann, as tip of the spear, she said there. But Tim Pawlenty says, hey, you're killing us. She went right back at him. Here was Bachmann attacking Republican contender Tim Pawlenty.
When you were governor in Minnesota, you implemented cap and trade in our state, and you praised the unconstitutional individual mandate, and you called for requiring all people in our state to purchase health insurance that government would mandate. Third, you said the era of small government was over. That sounds a lot more like Barack Obama, if you ask me.
Steve Chapman, lots of dynamics on that stage last night, but this may have been the most important one there in Ames, Iowa. What did you see going on?
Well, I think it's possible that both of them gained from that exchange. I mean, Bachmann was pretty unknown coming into this, and what she has had to do in a couple of debates and in her campaign is kind of establish herself as a serious candidate, somebody you can really think about as a possible nominee and a possible president. And I think each time she gets in one of these forums and she holds up to the criticism and so on, I think it helps her. Pawlenty is kind of trying to offer himself as the alternative to Bachmann, somebody who's conservative enough for the conservatives in the party, but it can also appeal beyond that. And that, I think, is why he directed his remarks at Bachmann rather than Romney, who, of course, is the front runner.
And so they go at each other. She said he implemented cap and trade. People came back and said, no such thing. Pawlenty complaining about her handle on facts, but she's got presence on that stage. Jack, what do you think? Is she a serious contender? Or, I mean, Wilder in Pittsburgh likes her. Does Mitt Romney have to worry about her? Or is it really Rick Perry that people are now saying he should be looking over his shoulder at?
Rick Perry, she began by saying that she would not have raised the debt ceiling. In fact, I think she said she would never raise the debt ceiling. Well, this is a week when everybody's 401k, everybody's college fund has taken a hit from precisely that kind of, you know, Luddite thinking about finance. I looked at corporate PAC giving. Of course, Romney is at the top. You know how much money corporate PACs have given her? In some ways, this is a good statement about her. $125. In other words,
wow.
She doesn't exist to the business wing of the Republican Party. They are terrified of someone who talks in this economically voodoo way about this tremendously complicated economy. She was asked, well, how would you create, you know, bring back jobs? And she said, well, within the first quarter of my being president, prosperity would start to come back. What kind of miracle talk is that? She has no credibility. And if she wins the Iowa caucus, it'll probably further marginalize that institution.
Jack, you say no credibility, but there's Wilder in Pittsburgh and many others around the country is saying, yes, please, we'll take some of that. Of course, the big target last night was Barack Obama himself. Let's listen to a little bit of that. Here was Mitt Romney saying he disagreed with how President Obama dealt with the recent debt ceiling debate.
Look, I'm not going to eat Barack Obama's dog food, all right? What he served up was not what I would have done if I'd have been president of the United States.
A lot of talk about eating dog food. Here was Tim Pawlenty talking about dinner and the president.
Where's Barack Obama's plan on Social Security reform, Medicare reform, Medicaid reform? In fact, I'll offer a prize tonight to anybody in this auditorium or anyone watching on television. If you can find Barack Obama's specific plan on any of those items, I will come to your house and cook you dinner.
Dog food, dinner at your house. Rana, what about it? This theme was emerging last night that, hey, the president never put his plans on paper. He doesn't have a plan. Does that sail?
I don't think it does. I mean, I think the general policy vectors of the Obama administration have been correct in a lot of ways. Certainly, the Democrats have a better thinking around job creation. The problem is that the political polarization over the last few years has made it difficult to get anything constructive through. And I think that, unfortunately, that's going to continue to be the case. I haven't heard anything, really, from the Republican side about how to really jumpstart job creation. And speaking of eating, I think Michelle Bachmann's going to be eating her words about prosperity. I'm not at all optimistic for the first quarter of any year upcoming.
Let's go to Iowa, Waverly, Iowa, and Mike. Mike, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm just amazed at the intelligence of the American people when, in this time when we're looking for jobs and trying to create jobs and all these people out of work, one of the Republican frontrunners is a man that made his fortune by buying a company, running it in the ground, and selling off the assets. And that's Romney, and it's been publicized that that's how he got rich. And the American people are sitting there and thinking he's something great, and that, wow, we need this man for president.
Well, Mike, what do you say to those who say, but that's the way you get efficiency? It hurts, but that's how you move the economy forward, win the future.
You don't. There's such a thing as being a little inefficient and having a job and being closed down so somebody can get rich and put you out of work.
Mike, we've got it. Steve Chapman, I'm going to bring that to you, but let me bring first just another Romney exchange, not in the debate hall, but actually at the Iowa State Fair this week. This one got a lot of play. He was standing there in the bales of straw, getting some trouble from not hecklers, but people really pressing him, and talked about who and what corporations are. The people some of the people in the audience, they're saying, raise taxes on corporations after, well, you'll hear Romney's suggestion.
We could raise taxes on people. That's not the way.
Corporations
are people, my friend. We could raise taxes on. Of course they are. Everything corporations earn ultimately goes to people. So, where do you think it goes?
It goes into their pockets.
What? Whose pockets? Whose pockets? People's pockets. Okay, human beings, my friend.
Human beings, my friend. Steve Chapman, how about Mitt Romney, his record, and how it's going to work for or against him as this whole thing moves forward?
Well, I think he came out well in that exchange, and I think that's the sort of thing that will help him with Iowa Republicans, where he's standing up to people who don't seem to understand how the market system works. I think his appeal is not so much the specifics of his what his businesses did, but that in this time of economic trouble, he has a good deal of experience in the private sector, which naturally makes a big contrast with Barack Obama, who has no business experience. And I think there is, to a lot of people, some inherent sense in having somebody with some business experience in the White House, given that we've tried the alternative and hasn't worked very well.
But what do you say to Mike, who just called in from Iowa, to say, yeah, but his experience is, you know, buy a company, gut the workforce, and make a bundle and move on?
You know, I'm not sure exactly which one he's referring to, but he did say, you know, you can tolerate some inefficiencies and have a job. You know, in this world, you really can't tolerate inefficiencies and preserve jobs, because you've got competitors who are going to be more efficient. And unless you have to do whatever it is to keep the company alive. And if that means cutting back on your workforce, and I speak with some feeling here coming from a company where we had some pretty big staff cuts, there are times when the only way to preserve a company, its viability and its competitiveness, is to reduce the size of your workforce.
We'll hear a lot more about that on the campaign trail. Steve Chapman, Rana Faruhar, Jack Beatty, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, three bank-robbing, gun-toting siblings on the run, the Doherty gang they've been dubbed, blazing away at police and captured in Colorado. Their mother begged them to surrender.
The only safe thing, the only right thing, the only good thing, possible thing to do is for you to turn yourselves in. I love you.
The guns are down now. They're in jail. Warren Jeffs, head of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, was sentenced by a Texas jury to life in prison this week for sexual assault. 79 wives, some as young as 12. His niece, Joshua Jeffs, testified against him for sexually assaulting her when she was a child.
You didn't disobey Warren. You did everything that Warren said. Nothing that he did was ever wrong. Ever.
And Comedy Central's Jon Stewart went after Newsweek magazine for its far less than glamorous cover shot of Congresswoman and GOP presidential candidate Michelle Bachmann. They had a lot of options, said Stewart.
Here she is screaming into a bullhorn and making it look attractive. My point is, you got to go pretty far out of your way to find a crappy photo of Michelle Bachmann, and you did. Why?
We're looking at a big week in the news. Market mayhem, London riots, Republicans girding for battle with Rana Faruhar of Time magazine, Steve Chapman from the Chicago Tribune, and our own Jack Beatty. Let's get another from Pittsburgh. Howard, you're on the air, Howard.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I noticed that none of the candidates from either party and none of your commentators will address the fact that the U.S. industrial base has been shipped overseas, largely due to unfair trade treaties that we've entered into over the past three decades. Everyone acts as though the economy can somehow recover without manufacturing jobs. I don't see how we can have an economy where we're all just trading paper with each other. To me, it looks like the only possible solution would be renegotiating those treaties and imposing fair tariffs on imports in order to keep people from shipping jobs out of the country.
Howard, we've got it. Rana Faruhar, is the United States in a position to renegotiate in that way anymore? I mean, they're talking about even the dollar maybe not being the reserve currency. One day Brazil, as you say, roaring ahead, China not doing it. Can we do that?
Absolutely. Well, you know, I actually don't agree about trade being the problem here, but I do agree that you need a stronger manufacturing base. And there's a lesson that we can take, and that's from Germany. This is a rich country that managed to keep a large chunk of its manufacturing sector with very high wages. How did they do it? Labor, business, and government came together. They all made sacrifices. You know, a caller earlier had made the point that he would say that we should sacrifice a bit of an efficiency for jobs. Can't sacrifice inefficiency, but what you can say is you can flatten wages out a little bit to keep jobs in the country, and that's what Germany did. Everybody, labor took some cuts, management took some cuts, the government subsidized keeping jobs in the country, and they've gone way up the food chain, and that's why unemployment in Germany is now 6.8%, in part because they make very high-end, high-skill equipment, very educated workers doing this, highly trained technical people. They ship them to China, where the markets are still booming, and they're prospering. So I think that that's a lesson for the U.S.
Big policy issues at play last night. The moderator from Fox News asked the entire panel, the entire stage full of Republican contenders, whether they'd be willing to go for deficit cuts if it meant a 10-to-1 ratio of spending cuts and just 10% new taxes. And every single person on the stage said no, they would not go with that. Steve Chapman, does that work? Does it work in the primary? Does it work in the general election? Does it work for the economy?
It's sort of an article of doctrine among Republicans that you're not allowed to question anymore. You know, Ronald Reagan obviously raised taxes many times during his time in office. You know, what strikes me as odd is that nobody in the Republican Party, or really anywhere else, is talking about balancing the budget in the next 5 or 10 years. Even Michelle Bachmann signed a pledge the other day to balance the budget without tax increases by 2017. Okay, that's 5 years down the road. That's going to be several trillion dollars in deficits between now and then, and yet she doesn't want to raise the debt ceiling or raise taxes. I think the only way in the short run to reduce the deficit is some tax increases, I mean, on top of spending increases. But, you know, the reforms that you're going to need for the big ticket items, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, those are not going to have a payoff in terms of reducing spending in the near future. That's something that's going to take 10, 15, 20 years to have big returns. And in the meantime, I think you're going to need some tax revenue as a way to close the gap.
Jack Beattie, I want to ask you about that, though. I mean, every single hand up saying, no way, I would take a, you know, $10 in spending cuts for every $1 in new taxes. There have to be people on that stage who know, I mean, in business, that's a great deal. But all those hands went up. Even John Huntsman, I want to talk about him. Of course, he did express some sympathy for John Boehner and his more open-to-compromise attitude, at least in tenor, in the debt ceiling debate. Let's listen to just a little bit of the former governor of Utah, John Huntsman, defending the debt deal last night.
We are the largest financial services sector by far in this entire world. And the thought that people would just let this nation default when we could have a deal that at least gets things going on cuts, raising the ceiling, gets us toward entitlement reform, gets us toward a balanced budget amendment, I thought Speaker Boehner should be complimented for what he did. This nation should never default.
So there's John Huntsman. What did you make of him last night, Jack? And what about that unanimous vote? No way they'd take a 10-to-1 deal, spending to tax cuts to tax cuts.
I thought he sounded like a statesman on the debt ceiling, but he sort of punted on the 10-to-1. I would have thought the consistent position was that he'd be the lone hand up looking for that moderate Republican who's got to be out there someplace, maybe not in the Iowa electorate. But surely lots of business people are attracted to the Republican Party. They would go for a 10-to-1 deal. You know, that 10-to-1 comment, I think that's a paradigm that shows how taking Tea Party positions that get, you know, applause from a Tea Party audience, is really giving hostages to fortune for whoever it is, the candidate that emerges in the general election. You can't run a general election campaign on that 10-to-1 basis. There's going to have to be a lot of walking back of positions taken to get right with this Tea Party electorate.
Donna in Buffalo, New York. You're on the air, Donna.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My comment is in reference to a previous caller and how he was concerned about Mitt Romney's past as a businessman and
cutting back staff. Yeah, okay.
Yes, and my concern is that the government and the United States is not a business. And to me, it kind of speaks to the psychology of perhaps the Republican Party or the right, that, you know, the lower class and the middle class are seen as inefficient in some respects because they're concerned about it and they don't really worry about it. So I just would like to hear if anybody has something to say, and I'll take my take it off here. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Donna, thank you very much for your call. Rana, I mean, here's the worry, you know. Yeah, that may be the way the market works, but what if that means sawing off a whole lot of Americans, leaving them high and dry?
Yeah, well, you know, in terms of Romney's business experience and what that brings to a potential candidacy, you know, he worked in big business, and big business, it has a problem in this country. Big business hasn't really created jobs in the last 30 years. Small business has created jobs. Unfortunately, they have lending problems, red tape problems, all kinds of issues. I mean, if we could get the sort of small and mid-sized business sector going again, we'd be in a lot better shape. I would also love to ask Mitt Romney why large American businesses are still sitting on $2.5 trillion of capital and when they're going to release it and where. I think that that's a big question. If the pendulum after the financial crisis swung towards the private sector, then to the public sector, I think now that the public sector is under so much pressure, we're going to see it swinging back to the private sector, and people people are going to be asking, why aren't these companies spending? And I think we ought to think about tax policy in relation to that as well.
Candy in Rutland, Vermont. Candy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I listened to the debate last night, and a couple things kind of stood out to me. Michelle Bachmann was given the question about her husband kind of encouraging her to work for the IRS and get certain degrees in her education.
And she became a tax lawyer there, right, right.
Yes, yes. And what the question was to her was that, you know, she has been called a submissive wife and kind of what did that mean in their relationship. And with her religious background, I think it means far more than she was willing to say. And maybe you can have some callers call in about this, but I believe a submissive wife in that kind of a religious home means that the husband makes all of the decisions. This is how it is in my sister's home, and the husband makes all of the decisions in the family. And I'm not knocking that. I'm just saying it seems very, very strange that someone could be running for president and yet call herself a submissive wife.
Yeah,
she did say that that meant mutual respect,
mm-hmm.
but I believe it means a whole lot more than that.
I mean, that's very interesting, and I appreciate your calling, Candy. There was Byron York of the Washington Times. He's been a guest with us. And he what he was keying off of there was Michelle Bachmann's own words, where she had said earlier at some point that she went down that path in part because her husband recommended it and she was being a submissive wife. Now, that's language that comes out. I've heard that any number of times in evangelical Christian sermons. It's not hard to find. Last night, Jack, she interpreted that as meaning that, hey, he was saying, what would it mean if you were president? She said, well, this is just a relationship of respect. Our caller Candy, with some firsthand knowledge here, says, you know, it means more than respect. It does, but should a presidential candidate be called to account for what it means to every evangelical Christian, Jack?
Well, I see that Byron has come under some criticism for that question. But, you know, there's a whole background, mental, intellectual background, theological background to Michelle Bachmann that's gone into at length in a Ryan Lizza column in the New York piece in The New Yorker this week. And really, just to describe it objectively, she comes out of a very to say esoteric, I'm not sure how to put it. But in any case, her views are far from mainstream American views on basic sort of church-state issues, on issues about gay rights, on issues about choice. And her tutors in this world of evangelical world have been people who've written books, at least, that take positions that wouldn't be comportable with mainstream America. Well, all I'm saying is her mental background, where that comes out of, is a whole worldview. And I think she did turn it nicely to say that means respect, but it's not the spin she gave it in 2006 when she was running. I remember that comment when she was running for Congress, and she said, I'm a submissive wife. I believe the comment was even made about sexual relations. I'm submissive that way. Well, okay, but
it can be a point of pride in a certain community.
Oh, of course.
And there it meets politics on the stage.
Yes, let me get a caller here,
Jack. Anita, Crenshaw County, Alabama. Anita, you're on.
I just want to make a quick point. Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I've seen a little bit of the Republicans last night. I don't like any of those clowns, except for Ron Paul. But I probably wouldn't vote for him. But the fact is, people have to realize the reason why we're in a mess we're in because of the choices people have made voting. I mean, people should realize Republicans just does not like the working class, and they don't have any interest in it, you know, for us. And so their obligation really just to corporate America, and that's what's killing this country. And they're not trying to make jobs here. And like I said, we're all just paying for it by the choices we make. People just really need to put more thought into their votes.
Anita, our time is short. I'd like to talk more, but our time is so short. Thanks for calling, and please call again. Thank you, Anita. Wise Virginia Joe, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm.
I think the biggest issue for me this week has been the London riots, and particularly I think people's analyses of them, and especially like what's going on and the motives for why people are doing stuff, and particularly in the British government, who have said, you know, that it's just rampant criminality and it's just hoodlums stealing stuff. But I think that really what's going on is much deeper and much more problematic than that. I think it's a systematic issue. You know, I think it's important to look at the system that has created this circumstance for these young people who are lower class, you know, who feel alienated and feel that they really have no sort of viable chance to become part of this of the system they're in. You know,
Joe, let us pick it up. Our time is short. David Cameron, the Prime Minister, they're absolutely looking at it the other way this week, saying, look, this is just criminality, pure and simple. Let's not make it a social, political dynamic here. But, Ron, I think I heard you earlier in the hour suggesting something else, something closer to what
Joe
said.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I know I couldn't agree more. I actually lived in London for 8 years. And London is a city very much like New York. It's a city that benefited tremendously from the run-up in the stock market over the last few years, a lot of wealth creation. But when the bubble burst, huge wealth divide. And I think that that's what you're seeing. I'm just surprised this didn't happen sooner. I think it was very clear from where these riots broke out, which tended to be in very poor neighborhoods with double-digit unemployment, particularly amongst youth, that were suffering from the austerity cuts. And those hit unemployed poor youth hardest. Educational subsidies were taken away, youth programs, job retraining, things like that. I think you can draw a direct line between inequality and the riots, and I think that you're going to see more of that in the years going forward.
Well, I want to give the last word here to the regular man who paid a heavy price this week and stepped up very prominently as that rioting spread to Birmingham. A local Muslim man watched his son and two others die in a hit-and-run accident amid the chaos. Muslim man. The next day, that father made this dramatic televised plea for Britons to stop the rioting.
Please respect the memory of our sons and the grief of our family and loved ones by staying away from trouble and not going out tonight. Basically, I lost my son. Blacks, Asians, whites, we all live in the same community. Why do we have to kill one another? What started these riots and what's escalated? Why are we doing this? I lost my son. Step forward if you want to lose your sons. Otherwise, calm down and go home.
There, calm, nobility, and wisdom in the words of a Muslim man in the United Kingdom who lost his son in the rioting there this week. Rana Faruhar, I want to thank you for being with us today. Great to have you. First time on, and we hope you'll come back. It's wonderful for you to join us. Thanks for joining us, Rana.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Rana Faruhar with Time Magazine. Steve Chapman, it's always great to have you from Chicago. We'll come back to you as Iowa goes forward. Thank you for joining us, Steve.
My pleasure.
And Jack Beatty, it's always great to have you here as well, every single week. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.